So what we were aiming at in this afternoon session was to give you an overview of some of the research going on campus. And so I think as we go from talk to talk, you'll see that there's all kinds of evolution research going on. And our next speaker will be operating at a very different scale. Our next speaker is Shannon Peters, who's a professor in the Department of Geology and Geophysics. Shannon's a paleontologist and a sedimentary geologist. He's leading the way with a new way of looking at the rock record that he calls macrostratigraphy, which involves quantitative analysis of gap-bound packages of sedimentary rocks. And then Shannon uses these analyses to examine questions about the evolution of marine and terrestrial life, looks at the carbon cycle and global climate, all kinds of interesting things you can do with these data. Shannon's not just a computer boy. He's also an excellent field geologist, and he's not going to talk about this in his talk, but I'm sure you could catch him later today and ask him about his recent field work with Phil Gingrich on the evolution of early whales in Egypt. He's done some really great stuff there. So the title of his talk now is On the Imperfection of the Geological Record.
Thank you, Dana, and thank you all for sticking around for the afternoon sessions. We appreciate it. And this was a hard one for me. It's a real honor, of course, to be speaking on Darwin's 200th birthday and the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species. A little bit humbling, in fact. And so I was sort of struggling about what to do for this presentation that would honor the occasion of the day. And so rather than sort of walk through some of the more details of the results that I've obtained recently by quantifying the rock record of North America that I'm excited about and we could go on at length about, I decided to talk a little bit about how aspects of these results relate to things I think Darwin would have found very interesting. Of course, Darwin, as many of you probably know, was a very good geologist. He had no formal training in the area of geology, but he was a keen observer of all things natural history. And rocks were certainly one of those aspects of natural history that he paid a lot of attention to. And so Charles Darwin, even if he never would have written The Origin of Species, I think it's pretty safe to say he would be well remembered for his many contributions to the field of geology. In fact, this is Darwin's rock hammer. If you ever get the chance to go to London, make sure you go to Down House and look at the wonderful exhibits they have. And this is Charles Darwin's very own rock hammer here. And he actually has published a number of rather influential works in geology, the spines of which are shown here. The Geology of South America. During his Beagle voyage, he was making a large number of geological observations that had a profound impact, I think, on his thinking about the evolution of species. He also did a very pioneering study of volcanic islands. We heard about the Galapagos early on. He was impressed by these volcanic islands, and he studied them extensively in their geological detail as well as their biological detail. He's probably best known for his work on coral reefs, and this is, of course, germane to what we heard about from Jeremy Jackson. Charles Darwin spent a lot of time looking at coral reefs on his Beagle voyage and compiling data and information about coral reefs from all over the world, in fact, and published a very influential work on the structure and distribution of coral reefs, which of course are rather different in today's oceans. And one of the interesting contributions he made is really explaining geologically the phenomenon of coral atolls, these peculiar little islands that are made of nothing but the skeletons of marine animals that stick up into the water just a little bit. And Darwin realized that this recorded a dynamic surface process on the Earth. And this slow, gradual change that he inferred from the distribution of coral reefs and their development on volcanic islands really, I think, emphasized his gradual perception of how evolution works, as well as geological processes. And of course, you've probably heard about the earthquake he witnessed on the western edge of South America, where he actually saw the land come out of the water and stranding a beach up above the surface of the ocean, bringing with it the fossils now of the marine organisms that were there. And that had a profound impact on his thinking about how origins, mountain belts, evolved. And just for kicks and giggles, he also collected a lot of fossils, and this is actually a specimen that Darwin collected that I was able to handle in London. It was a great treat. And of course, Darwin collected a large number of fossils that ended up having a big impact on our thinking of the history of life on Earth, such as Megatherium, giant clam sloth that we heard about earlier. We could have a whole seminar, probably, on just Charles Darwin as a geologist, and if you're interested, you can read more about a about Charles Darwin and his geological exploits in a recent book that does a pretty good job of laying out his contributions. And I would also highly recommend you go to this website if you haven't already. It's Darwin Online. It's a phenomenal compilation of all of his works that you can download for free in PDF form and read the original manuscripts. It's just and search them. It's really a phenomenal resource. And you'll see images that come from those PDFs in this talk. But what I want to do today is really focus on the origin of species, you know, because that's why we're here and celebrating this day in particular. Talk about a few aspects of the geological thinking that's in the origin of species. And in particular, well, this isn't hard to do, actually. There are two chapters devoted entirely to the subject of geology, and geological thinking is all through the origin of species. And one of them is the motivation for the title of the talk. Now, Darwin called it On the Imperfection of the Geological Record, and he spent a great deal of time worrying about the completeness of the fossil record and the implications of that fossil record for his theory of evolution. There's a whole chapter also devoted to the geological succession of the organic beings that we find in the geological record. We could, again, go on at length about all of the topics he raised in these two chapters, but I want to focus really on two things. His statement on the poorness of our paleontological collections and on the intermittence of geological formations. Just those two points. I'll show you some results from my own work that are relevant to these two points. This pretty much summarizes, I think, Darwin's idea of on the poorness of geological collections. And this is how he opens his argument. That our paleontological collections are very imperfect is admitted by everyone. And at first, this statement was a little confusing to me when I read it from a modern perspective, because Darwin had specimens like this. This is Archaeopteryx, of course, a very famous fossil that bridges the gap morphologically between theropod dinosaurs and birds, combining in a sort of chimeric fashion traits of both of those groups. It wasn't recognized as sort of an intermediate fossil at the time, despite the fact that people knew about it, including Darwin. So it's a little perplexing. And from a modern perspective, of course, we've got a great diversity of, following up on Archaeopteryx, of fossil forms, some of which are absolutely exquisite, that link very clearly morphologically the transition between theropod-like dinosaurs and modern birds. So it's a little bit perplexing, but the key is paleontological collections, not specimens, paleontological collections, the integrated fossil record, the body of knowledge in the fossil record, not the beauty of a single specimen. Okay, so this statement of Darwin's raises the question, well, how imperfect are paleontological collections? Exactly how imperfect? Can we measure it? What do we need to measure it? So there's two things we need to worry about in answering this question. One is the paleontological collections part. What exactly does that mean? Life is diverse, of course, and so in the inclusive sense, paleontological collections would be remains of everything that was alive on Earth. That's one way to define it. We're actually going to focus on one particular subset of the living world that the Earth kind of gives to us as the best fossil record. And the Earth gives it to us for a very specific reason, and that is geologically one of the most remarkable things about our planet is that it's very bimodal. So we have these high elevation things that float around that we walk on called the continents. They stick up high in elevation, and we have these big, deeper things that hold water because they're so deep called the ocean basins. And to a first approximation, these things that stick up high out of the oceans wear away by the processes of wind, water, and ice, and that sediment is carried out and deposited into oceans, to a first approximation. The problem with the very deep oceans is that seafloor that underlies them is continually being generated and recycled through the processes of plate tectonics. So the sediment's trying to go from here into there, but it can't stick around here for very long because of this active dynamic surface. And so it's sort of a conundrum, or ironic, I guess, that the very life raft that the fossils are floating on is the one that's supplying the debris that eventually forms the fossil record. It's kind of like Wallace and his boat, you know. It's this life raft, but at the same time, it comes at a pretty good cost. And the end result is that the fossil record is dominated by things like clams and snails and corals that live in shallow marine settings that cover little bits and pieces of the continent. So they get up on this life raft and stick around geologically for a long period of time. They have shells and they enter the fossil record. And of course, this is why the state fossil of Wisconsin is this thing, a trilobite that was a little marine critter, not unlike a crab, I guess, that wandered around a shallow sea that used to cover Wisconsin. Okay, those are the rocks that dominate the continents. So we're going to limit our investigation, the paleontological part here, to skeletonized marine invertebrates, because that's the sort of best fossil record we would expect to have. The other part of the question here is how imperfect. What does imperfect mean? How do we measure perfection in the fossil record? There's a variety of ways we might do that. One way is to take a group of organisms. Let's just assume for a second that these 100 gastropods represented every species of a particular group of gastropods. If we look at the fossil record of those, we might find that only 6 of the 100 are actually found and known as fossil objects. Okay? And one measure of perfection in the rock record might just simply be to simply count up the total number of fossil species that we have and divide that by the total number of species that have ever lived in that group. That would be one measure of the completeness of the fossil record. Okay, well, we can sort of do this. We know about how many fossil species. It's hard to actually make a list of this because of the way the data are distributed around our collective knowledge at the present time. It's somewhere in the order of 210,000 fossil species. This is the harder one, the total number of species ever lived. How do we do that? Well, we need to come up with some model of species over geologic time, since time is implicit in that. And we have a few places to get started in filling in our model in geologic time and the number of species. One is about the total number of skeletonized marine invertebrates of this category that are known in the modern world. Again, this is a tough one to estimate too. Jeremy could probably give us a much better estimate. I would estimate it to be around 200,000. As you see, we can play with these considerably and it doesn't have much effect. The other point we are pretty confident about is that somewhere at about 550 million years, give or take a few million years, it was at zero. Animals evolved and diversified. So somewhere between there and there, we have to build a model of diversity. How do you want to do that? Well, there's a number of ways. You might draw a line. You might say it's exponentially increasing. You might say it's some sort of logistic thing. Or you just might draw any old way you'd like. Okay. Well, it turns out there are ways to sort of constrain this, although it doesn't actually matter that much. So here's an empirical record compiled by Jack Sapkowski at the University of Chicago that shows the total number of marine animal genera in this case, which are a good proxy for species typically, and how they have diversified over time. And starts low and goes up high, and the two points in between need to get connected. For today, we're just going to do it with the straight line. And you'll see in a second that it doesn't actually matter too much what your specific model is. Okay, so that's a start. We need one other bit of information. The average species duration is about 4 million years, it turns out, in the fossil record, empirically. We can play with that number as well. So now we have all the pieces. We can simply increment our total number of species that ever lived up this line. That's the slope. And every time we do this, we leave some behind by the process of extinction, and they become incorporated in the fossil record. And when you solve for that, it's about 13 million or so total number of species that have ever lived. The message there is the vast majority of species that have ever lived are extinct. Okay, and of that, we have about 210,000, it's about 2%. Now, you can change the area under this curve here by factors of 2 or so and adjust that number accordingly. You can adjust the species duration and so forth. Give or take a factor of 3, that's about the completeness of the fossil record, so about 2%. Okay, so what? What that means is that on average, we have about 2% of all the little lineages, we'll call them species, that have ever lived. So this is the only figure in the Origin of Species, very brilliant one. You should have more, but this is a good one. And so what that means is that we might have something like this in the fossil record. We have, in actuality, a diverse branching history of descent with modification and divergence being the key, and some sampling of that. And it looks pretty poor, 2%, that's not very much. But actually, it's a lot. That 2% is distributed all across the tree of life and all through geologic time, from the very first animal to the present. And so, although it's true that we're missing, 98% or so of the individual lineages that probably would have linked something like a lobe-finned fish to a full-fledged tetrapod, we nevertheless have an incredible diversity of fossils that provide intermediate clues about that morphological evolution. And it's for pretty much every group of organism you can think of. Whales, again, probably about 2% of them of all the species have actually been found, probably even less than that. And nevertheless, we have fossils that document very precisely the transition from a terrestrial tetrapod to a marine behemoth that still has vestiges of its ancestry. And in fact, the discoveries, of course, still keep coming in. That 2% is only going to go up with time. Just this week, my colleague Philip Gingrich at the University of Michigan published a new paper that describes not only how these primitive whales gave birth on land, but also morphological evidence that actually fills in yet another component of this chain, very incomplete chain, that links taxa by branching processes and descent with modification. And of course, yes, even our own lineage, our own family tree is remarkably, surprisingly, in my opinion, well represented in the fossil record. So, yes, Darwin was absolutely correct. The fossil record is very imperfect, but so what? Almost all of our scientific knowledge is based on a very small sample. When we describe a species, we don't sample every individual. We describe it, 2% would be great. We rarely get even close to that to describe and characterize a species. Sampling is pretty good. Locally, it can be spectacular in the case of those feathered dinosaurs. Globally, that's probably about 2%. Why? Why is it incomplete? That's the next question. Darwin talked about this, and he explained it on the intermittence of geological formations. And he spells it out right here. The several formations, the rock units in which fossils are found, are separated from one another by wide intervals of time. Didn't say how much, he just said wide intervals of time. And it's during these times that evolution was happening. So when you look at it, it looks disjunct. So here's an example. Here's the Grand Canyon. And you look into the Grand Canyon, it's beautiful because of the different rocks have different colors. And those different colors correspond to different environments. And they have names, okay? So these are the rock units Darwin was talking about. And if you go collect fossils from these sedimentary rock units, you will find exactly what Darwin said. The fossils contained within each one of these geological formations are completely distinct from the ones above it. There's virtually no overlap. Okay, so there's lots of truncations of lineages. And as Darwin predicted, although he had no way to measure it at the time, in fact, if you unstack these sediments from their stacked vertical position in the rock record and put them back into their correct temporal position in geological history, this is approximately what it looks like from 2.5 billion years ago all the way to the recent. They're little chunks of rock separated by vast intervals of time, just like Darwin predicted. So Darwin hypothesized in the origin that rock truncations cause false species truncations that sort of chop off an evolutionary history. Okay, now this makes a very specific hypothesis. What it says is that if there's a gap in our evolutionary trajectory up a tree, that the end result will be the juxtaposition vertically in the rock record of this. And so you'll see an abrupt offset. And this is a way for him to explain the absence of intermediates in the fossil record. Okay? And of course, if you could find a place where that was not the case, you would see a more continuous succession that preserved all the intermediates that Darwin envisioned. Okay, so this hypothesis makes some very specific predictions. In the rock record, we should see these truncations. So this is what the rock record looks like in this part of the world. The details are important. The rocks are the colored parts. The gaps in time are the white parts. We can simply count up these rock truncations and see if they're correlated with fossil species truncations. And the test is to do this empirically in the rock record. And this, I've done this over North America. And to cut to the chase, this is what the results look like. It suggests that Darwin was about right. Rock truncations, the number of rock truncations in these formations, are in fact correlated with the number of truncations of lineages in the fossil record. That's interesting. It supports Darwin's hypothesis and suggests there might be something to it. But let's think about it a little more. What he's really saying is that it's not the truncations in the rock record that are important. It's the gaps, how much time actually is there. If you have just a little truncation, like that little black line, well, there's not much of an offset in your tree. If you have a little bit more time missing, there's a little bit more of an offset. If you have a lot of time missing, well, you're going to see a very profound... So it's not really the gap truncation that's important. It's the duration of your missing information that's important. Well, that's also a hypothesis that makes a prediction. It's not the rocks that are important, like Darwin sort of formulated it. It's actually the intervening gaps that are important. And the bigger the gap on average, the bigger the truncation should be. And this, again, we can test by simply measuring, forgetting about the rocks, measuring the gaps in between the rocks and testing this hypothesis exactly. The bottom line is when you do that, there is no correlation. There's nothing about the duration of the missing time between the rocks that predicts what we see in the truncations of genera in the fossil record. Okay, so this test is rather convincingly failed. Okay, so what does this mean? What this means is that Darwin was right in recognizing that the fossil record is very incomplete And he was right in recognizing that there's structure preserved in the rock record that predicts something about how those lineages are distributed in geological time. But the truncations in the rock record themselves are related to and controlled by processes that are actually very important to biological evolution. Things like tectonics and climate are actually controlling those gaps. They're not there for no reason. They're driven by very specific causes that are related to the evolution of continents tectonically and evolution of continents in terms of climate. And we know both of those things can cause important changes in the biological world. And so the lesson, I think, from the initial stages of my research is that the rock record encodes an imperfect biological story, but the imperfection itself actually contains a lot of information about the processes that might be contributing to biological evolution. Thank you.
Let's take time for one quick question, if there is one.
Is that record available online?
Which one, I'm sorry?
The one that has to do with click-click.
Oh, yes, that's wrong. If you type North America paleogeography in Google, you're bound to get it right away. You have to stitch it together yourself, but you'll find individual images. And it's Ron Blakey at the University of Arizona.
Okay.